90 a.m. in Montreal.
You are listening to CJLO News. Orange haze, a blood-red sun, and murky skies as harmful wildfire smoke hangs in the air over Montreal, floating east from the prairie fires raging in Canada. On Friday, June 6th, Montreal's air quality was declared the second worst for major cities in the world, according to the World Air Quality Index ranking. Santiago, Chile is number one on that list, but at number three is Toronto, Ontario, which is being affected by the same prairie fire smoke. Environment and Climate Change Canada has issued a special air quality statement for Greater Montreal and is encouraging people to stay home with their windows closed if possible. Donnie Cito is a climate change researcher at Concordia. He analyzes climate data and looks at urban adaptability. Cito called the wildfire smoke a signal of larger climate problems.
It's just a signal, right? But it is one that we see, and it's all encompassing because it basically surrounds us. Instead of just waiting for these events to happen and then dealing with them, it should be an alarm to kind of say, well, you know, we really need to deal with not just the symptoms, but the causes, and really put our attention to mitigation at this point, and not just because we can always adapt. But if the baseline is going to change every year, then the adaptations that we're going to kind of invest in now are probably not going to be relevant in the future. So unless we stop climate change from getting worse, no matter how much money we throw at it, specifically if we do kind of very moderate adaptation, it likely won't be kind of effective later on.
Jill Baumgartner is the director of McGill's Center for Climate Change and Human Health. Baumgartner stresses that health risks related to climate change are becoming a regular fact of life and encourages citizens to plan for more frequent extreme weather events.
So I think on the health side, it's important to know that, right? What does this actually mean when we're talking about health impacts of climate change? But also thinking about what you can do to protect your health, right? So one thing might be, if you're thinking about heat waves, we know that they're going to happen in the summer. So it might be a good idea to have a plan in place, right? Because if you have someone in your household who's maybe older, or maybe you have a young infant, they would be particularly vulnerable. And so it would be good to have a plan in place for that, similar for wildfires, right? If you are older, you have other pre-existing conditions, we know that they're the most impacted by those health impacts. So that's where we would like to ideally see, both public health agencies are, we see public health in Montreal, playing a big role in trying to help prepare communities for that. But individuals can also do things themselves, like have air filters or have a plan in place if it gets too hot, or, have a system in place of people around them in communities if there's a flood, right? So understanding those health impacts is really about preparing yourself and your family so that they can stay safe when these events happen.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Adam Innes.
I can see her lying back in her satin dress, in a room where you do what you don't confess. Sundown, you better take care. If I find you've been creeping round my back steps, sundown, you better take care. If I find you've been creeping round my back steps. She's been looking like a queen in a sailor's dream. She don't always say what she really means. Sometimes I think it's a shame when I get feeling better when I'm feeling no pain. Sometimes I think it's a shame when I get feeling better when I'm feeling no pain.
every move that a man could make. Getting lost in her loving is your first mistake. Sundown, you better take care. If I find you've been creeping round my back steps, sometimes I think it's a sin. When I feel like I'm winning, when I'm losing again.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Tommy John Show here on CJLO 1690 AM in Montreal. Hope everyone's doing well. Man, what a weekend we just had in the world of sports. What a week ahead we have in the world of sports. Just so much to get into over the next hour here on the Tommy John Show. If you are new to the program, remember to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, now X, whatever you want to call it, Facebook, you name it, the Tommy John Show is on it. And if you miss any portion of the program, remember, check our Instagram out. Monday afternoons, I will post the entire show there if you missed it. So follow at the Tommy John Show for that. What a weekend we had. What a weekend we had. We had huge games in the NBA and NHL finals. We know where we stand after the home games for both Oklahoma City in the NBA and Edmonton in the NHL. We'll get into those ones. We had maybe one of the greatest tennis matches of all time over the weekend. Two of them. But the women's one was fantastic between Coco Gauff and Sabalenka. We'll get into that one. And then when you think you couldn't get any better, you have the men's final from yesterday. We will get into that classic here on the program. Ryan Fox, the Kiwi, the New Zealander, winning the Canadian Open, exempt for the U.S. Open now. And it is U.S. Open week. We'll get into that at Oakmont starting Thursday. And man, Aaron Rodgers is officially picked an NFL team. We will get into all of this over the next hour on the Tommy John Show, but we will start off quickly with the Stanley Cup playoffs, just because we have Game 3 tonight in Sunrise, Florida. The Florida Panthers and the Edmonton Oilers deadlocked at one game apiece. Both games have been decided in overtime. Edmonton taking game one on a Leon Draisaitl overtime winner on the power play. And then on Friday night, Corey Perry tying it late with seconds to go. It goes to double overtime where Brad Marchand, what a pickup he's been for Florida, scores his second of the game in double overtime, and the Florida Panthers evened up the series at one. So we got game three tonight. And my takeaway from the first two games has been Edmonton looks faster. They have McDavid. They have Draisaitl. Bouchard can skate all over the ice. Evander Kane's flying out there. Nugent Hopkins. They've got more speed. But I don't know what it is with Florida. They just seem to slow them down at certain points of the game. Florida looks better. I want to knock Edmonton defensively because they've played very well defensively, but they don't give up much. Bobrovsky's been pretty good. And again, it's that third line. It's that second line doing damage for the Panthers. It's Sam Bennett. It's Marchand. It's Lundell. It's those kind of guys who are getting production for Florida. And that's going to be the difference in the series, I think. McDavid was phenomenal through the first two games. Draisaitl's been phenomenal. And that is just a game-changing thing to have. But if you look at Florida's depth, I can't get over that. They can just, the first line, okay, Tkachuk is, he's not healthy, clearly not himself, but they still have Barkov, they still have Sam Bennett, they still have Verhaeghe. Then you go down to Marchand and Lundell, and then the back end with Jones and Mikkola, Ekblad. It's just so much depth on this Florida Panthers roster, and I wonder how that's going to play a factor the rest of the way. Will Edmonton's top-end talent overcome just the Florida Panthers' depth? And honestly, when Perry tied it with whatever it was, 30 seconds left, 20-something seconds left, I just thought, you know what? This is McDavid and the Oilers' year. It's just something about it. They're getting the bounces. They get a power play in overtime. They win it there in a pretty even overtime. They were down and out of this hockey game after the first period. The second period, again, Florida dominated. And they were just looking to get something. And then, of course, Corey Perry, the 40-year-old wonder, ties it up. And then they had great chances in overtime. And then Marchand should have scored earlier in overtime, and it hits the post. I don't know how that doesn't go in. Goes right under Skinner's pad, doesn't go in. And I just thought to myself, Edmonton's, it's just the hockey gods want McDavid and Draisaitl to get one. And it goes to double overtime. And then, of course, Brad Marchand, at 37 years of age, still playing at an elite level, gets it done. So here we are. We are deadlocked at one. Now, Edmonton's got to get one of these games on the road. You can't go back down 3-1. They're going to come for a split. They will take a split and run because they believe they have one of the great home ice advantages in the NHL, which they do. Which they do. That crowd and that building was rocking for games 1 and 2. But I think the big difference in this series is a healthy Leon Draisaitl for Edmonton. Because McDavid was unbelievable last year, but you can tell by the end, Draisaitl last year in the finals was nowhere near his best. And everyone knew what he was playing through and how injured he was. He looks healthy. He looks great. Even on the Marchand overtime goal, he did just an amazing job to get back there on the back check. He's flying around the ice too. So just having those two guys and Edmonton being able to just throw those guys over the boards, it's huge for them. Now, Hyman has been a big loss, but Ekholm has been great. Bouchard, he's getting a lot of points, but those two Marchand goals, you know, you got to look at him for that. But he's been pretty solid. And I think Darnell Nurse has been pretty good as well. So these teams are really evenly matched. Stuart Skinner, listen, he's making time. He's giving up goals. He's making some big saves. But that double overtime winner Marchand scored, he wants that one back. Just right through the five hole. That's a tough one to let in. But as I sit here right now, I said earlier last week, it's a 50-50 series. After two games, it's a 50-50 series. And it's going to come down to who takes advantage of, obviously, the special teams and the penalties, but also who handles the moment better. And Florida will always have, until this series is over, the mental advantage of winning last year. But watching McDavid and watching Draisaitl, it looks like they won't be denied. It looks like, and I know they lost last night, but that McDavid assist to Draisaitl, where he just completely undressed Barkov and then Ekblad to slide it over to Draisaitl, was one of the great assists you'll ever see. I just get McDavid is going to give every single ounce of hockey he has left this year. I don't care how tired he is. I know how much hockey he's played. He's going to just go all out for these next, hopefully, five games. We want seven games of this series. Trust me. He's playing out of his mind, and I just feel like that's going to be the difference. I think Florida's the better team, better built, but 97 and 29 are on the Oilers, and a healthy 29 as well. So I feel like that's going to be a big factor. What I will say about this game tonight is I'm interested to see how Edmonton responds, because that was a dramatic win on in game one. They put all their effort into scoring that tying goal. They get to double overtime. They had their chances in overtime, and it doesn't go their way. Florida went to Edmonton looking for a split. They all said that. They got their split. They're happy. They're coming back home. I want to see how Edmonton comes out tonight. They always play well to start. But I need to see that continue that, play well to start the first period, and then take it into the second period. Because games one and games two, they were horrendous in the second period. Horrendous. Now, a lot of that has to do with Florida just weathering the storm in the first period and then playing their game in the second period. But I have thought at least Edmonton would show up in game two in the second period because of how bad it was in game one. It could have been even worse. Skinner made some big saves, and they were lucky that was all that would happen in the second period. But Florida, in the second period, were just taking it to the Oilers, and Edmonton has to respond. I'm sorry, they started off well. They started the games well. Even when Florida scored first, it was the first period. They settled in, matched them. But in the second period, they just get blown off the ice. So that is I want to see Edmonton do tonight. Start off well, play a good road game, and then take that into the second period. They got to, because that's where Florida feasts. In the second period, the middle parts of games, that's where they'd like to take advantage of you. And that's where they've done a lot of their damage, and the most of their damage, in this series thus far. So I cannot wait for game three tonight, and we'll talk a bit more about it later in the program. We'll quickly go over to the NBA, And Oklahoma City, I don't know how the hell they lost game one. Indiana just somehow wins these miraculous basketball games. We saw it game one against the Knicks. We saw it against in the Cleveland series as well. Indiana just wins these wild games. They're down double digits with 5 minutes, 4 minutes left in a basketball game, and then they just start hitting threes, hitting big shots, and then they give the ball to Halliburton, and away he goes, and he'll hit the game winner. They came, like Florida, to Oklahoma City looking for a split, and they got a split. And Oklahoma City were ticked off that they lost that basketball game. They were the much better team. Indiana had a million turnovers in game one. They were nowhere near as sharp as the Oklahoma City Thunder for 3.5 quarters. And they just had a miraculous last 4 minutes, and they won the basketball game. That resulted in yesterday in Oklahoma City being ticked off and just annihilating them. 123-107. And Shai was unbelievable, so efficient. He had 34 points, 8 assists. But that is the Oklahoma City Thunder we were used to. They closed the game out strong. They played great defense. Didn't let Halliburton do his thing. Didn't let Siakam get comfortable. And they looked fantastic. Now, I'm interested to see how they play on the road, because Indiana is one of the great home teams in the NBA. Look what they did in Game 6 against the Knicks. Look what they did in Game 4 against the Knicks. They just love playing at home. And it's going to be hard for Oklahoma City to pick off two, I think, in Indiana. I think Oklahoma City will be saying, hey, let's get the split and get home court back. But right now, you have to say Oklahoma City are still the favorites. They look like the better team. They look far more comfortable. They're better defensively. But this is a much closer series than people were saying beforehand. Oklahoma City were just monster favorites going into the series. Based on all the sports books, all the analysts, no one thought Indiana had a chance. And then you see Indiana pull off that miraculous win in game one, and they're in this series. They, trust me, they said, if we can get one out of these first two in Oklahoma City, we will take that and sprint back home to Indianapolis. That's what they were saying, and that's what they did. They stole game one, and they were not saying we're complacent, but their job was done after one game. But now they got to hold serve. If they win both at home and they go back to Oklahoma City with a 3-1 lead, still home court, that would be massive for Indiana. Massive. But trust me, Oklahoma City's still a ticked-off basketball team. They think they should be up 2-0. And honestly, based on every single statistic you looked at, they should be up 2-0. They weren't turning the ball over. They were just far better defensively. Indiana were just so careless with the basketball. And then that was a full game ago. I'm still stunned that they won that one. And trust me, Oklahoma City is still stunned as well. So they're going to be coming out fiery, ticked off, and ready to roll when they head to Indiana later this week. But credit to the Pacers to taking that first game, but credit Oklahoma City for responding last night. They destroyed Indiana and made a statement as well. And what I really liked about Oklahoma City game last night, yes, Shai looked like his MVP self, but the other guy showed up. Let's give him credit. Jalen Williams showed up. Chet Holmgren gave a nice little production. Alex Caruso gave him 20 points last night. Aaron Wiggins showed up. There's a whole bunch of players who showed up for Oklahoma City. And it was, as great as Shai was, the surrounding cast helped out. And if you can have an MVP player play at that level and then get help from your other guys as well, especially guys coming off the bench, then you'd be a very tough team to beat. And that's what Oklahoma City did last night. They look terrific. So we'll talk a bit more about both of those finals later on in the program. What we will get into now was that French Open final that happened over the weekend. That was one of the great, I want to say, tennis matches of all time, because it is one of the great sporting events I've ever seen. And I'll quickly just say the women's match on Saturday was phenomenal as well. Coco Gauff losing the first set to Sabalenka, fighting back, clawing back, and then winning the next two sets rather comfortably, 6-2, 6-4, after losing the first set in a tiebreak. And everyone was talking about Sabalenka's comments saying Coco didn't play her best. I was just really bad and all that stuff. She later apologized. It was heat of the moment, she said. But that was kind of a bad thing to say, trying to take all the credit away from Coco Gauff. The only reason she won is because I played bad. But maybe it was Coco Gauff's spin on the ball or the shot she was placing that made you play bad. Maybe that was a factor too. But anyway, she just was not gracious in defeat at all on Saturday afternoon. She later apologized, said Coco played great, all that stuff. It's because her PR team said, hey, what the hell are you doing? So that was a great match on Saturday. And I didn't think we would get the classic we got yesterday was going to happen. I thought we were going to get good, high-quality tennis. We saw these two, Sinner and Alcaraz, play in Rome a few weeks ago, and Alcaraz won in straight sets. We obviously, it was a great match last year between these two at the French Open semis when Alcaraz got him. Obviously, that Beijing final later in the year last year, that was a great contest as well. I thought we'd get a four or five set match. I did not think we were going to get the drama we got yesterday. So if you missed the match or and you haven't watched much tennis recently, Jannik Sinner from Italy, the number one player in the world, Carlos Alcaraz, number two player in the world, they are both in their early 20s. Heading into yesterday, they have won they were the holders of the last five majors. Sinner won the U.S. Open last fall, won the Australian Open in January, and Alcaraz won Wimbledon last year, won the French last year. And if you go back a year prior in Australia, Sinner won that one as well. So the last five majors played in tennis before yesterday were all won by Sinner and Alcaraz. They're both in their early 20s. So that streak was continuing regardless today. If Sinner won that one, he would have had his fourth major. Alcaraz would have, if Alcaraz won, he would have had his fifth major. So there was all the storyline, Sinner can tie Alcaraz in majors and all this stuff. La da la da la. Alcaraz has beaten him four times in a row. But Sinner, throughout the entire tournament and throughout the last month since he's been back from his suspension, has looked utterly dominant against everyone not named Carlos Alcaraz. So if you looked at the tournament, all the experts, hey, Sinner looks like the more dominant player, but somehow when he plays Alcaraz, he can't beat him. Yesterday, that match starts. Alcaraz looks good, gets an early break, and then in that first set, Sinner just flicked on the switch and then was dominant. Won the first set, played amazing the last three games there, broke Alcaraz to win the set. Then they go to the second set, and Alcaraz needs that one. Going down 2-0 to Jannik Sinner, who in this tournament had not lost a set. And they were showing the graphic on the TV. Jannik Sinner had won 30 straight sets in majors. 30 straight sets at majors. And once he won that tiebreak in the second set, Alcaraz didn't need to take just one set off him. He needed to win three straight sets to win the French Open title. And it wasn't looking pretty for him. He got broken the first game of the third set. I'm thinking, oh boy, he's just being outclassed today. Sinner's on another level. What happens next? Carlos Alcaraz breaks back and then plays the best tennis of the match by either player to get it to 5-3. The serving out the second set. What happens? He gets broken. Oh boy, now all the momentum's gone. Sinner has this to serve, to get back on serve. No. 5-4, serving to get to 5-5. Alcaraz breaks him to win the set. So now we're going to the fourth set. The fourth set going pretty standard. No. Oh no. Sinner gets the break. Now it's 5-3. Alcaraz is serving to stay alive. At 5-3. Sinner comes out firing. He gets it to love 40. Jannik Sinner in the fourth set. 6-4, 7-6, 4-6, 5-3, love 40. Three championship points to win the French Open. Alcaraz gets out of the game. Saves all three match points. Then wins the deuce point. Wins his advantage, holds the game, it's 5-4. Crowd's going crazy, but still for Sinner, okay, I let three championship points get away. As one of the great servers in recent memory, I'm still serving to win the French Open at 5-4. What happens? Alcaraz breaks him at 5-4, and now we're 5-5 on serve. And then Alcaraz had all the momentum after that, takes it to a tie break. And when he's down 0-2 in the tie break, he just turned it on, played unbelievable in that tie break, wins it 7-3. Now we're at two sets apiece. Alcaraz has done the impossible, saved match points, took two sets in a row off Sinner, who hadn't dropped the set the whole tournament, and he didn't just play snowflakes. Trust me, Sinner played Novak Djokovic, and he played other high-quality players en route to this final. He wasn't playing you and me. He smoked Rublev, smoked Bublik, smoked Djokovic. He wasn't playing just ordinary people here. And he still hadn't lost a set. So we go to the fifth and deciding set. And I'm telling you, it's not like these points were, man, these were just jaw-dropping points, the shot-making, everything. We were getting unbelievable rallies. Now we're at like 4.5 hours heading to this set. And Alcaraz looks fresher. Sinner's cramping, and then Alcaraz gets the first break. He breaks him in the first game. Oh boy, Sinner might be in trouble. He's holding his leg. He looks like he's cramping out. Alcaraz has done it. And Alcaraz is holding serve. It's a bit tough though, but he's holding serve. He's keeping it going, keeping the points alive. I don't know. Oh, break point for Sinner. He would save it. And every time Sinner would get close to a break, Alcaraz would come up with a big serve and then hold it. Then we get to 5-4. Or 5-3, I think. I forget exactly what it was now. Alcaraz serving for the French Open. Serving for the French Open. Sinner has no legs left. And Sinner breaks him. The nerves get to Alcaraz a little bit, breaks him. And now we're back on serve. Then what happens? Sinner has to hold his serve in a crazy long drawn out game. Incredible shot making, all of that. Then Alcaraz now is serving at 5-6, having to hold his serve to force a tiebreak. Sinner gets close, 15-30, and then Alcaraz's shot making from that point on was jaw-dropping. He did not miss a shot. Gets it to 6-6. Now we have a 1-10 having to win by 2 tiebreak. And I've never seen, and I've been a fan of Federer my whole life, watched him against Nadal, watched him against Djokovic, Murray, Wawrinka. I've seen all those players play. That level that Alcaraz played that tiebreak with, that level he played at, was one of the high, if not the highest I've ever seen. He did not miss a shot for the first 7-8 points of that tiebreak. He was up 7-0 to start. And you can tell Sinner was done. Not because he was playing bad. He wasn't playing bad shot. He wasn't getting tight. Alcaraz was hitting winners and hitting outrageous shots. And he gets to 9-2. And, of course, on championship point, Alcaraz hits maybe the best winner of the match on the run. Sinner had no chance to get it. Falls to the ground. And Carlos Alcaraz, in 5 hours and 29 minutes... wins the French Open, was down two sets, saved three match points 2 hours earlier, and defended his title at Roland Garros, and is now 5-0 in his last 5 meetings against Jannik Sinner. And if you think about Sinner, he has dominated everyone else on tour. Djokovic, Zverev, Tsitsipas, Casper Ruud, Taylor Fritz, you name it. Go through that top 10, top 20. In the world, Sinner has destroyed everyone except for Carlos Alcaraz. And Alcaraz has the ability to lose to Francis Tiafoe. He's done that before. Lose to a Musetti. Lose to just Djokovic at an older age. It's really strange that other players can feel like they can beat Alcaraz and not beat Sinner. And then when Alcaraz plays Sinner, he just goes to another level. And I really think the shot making throws off Sinner. I really do. I'm not saying that. They were so evenly matched. They're by far right now the two best players in the world. And to think that they're both in their early 20s, I think Alcaraz is 22, Sinner's 23. To think that those guys are both in their early 20s and they're playing at this level, if they stay healthy, imagine how good they'll be when they're 26, 27 in their physical primes. It's going to be a scary sight. But tennis was in a weird spot because you just had the three greatest players of all time all playing at the same time with Federer, Nadal, and Djokovic, all playing their best tennis. No one having a chance. Maybe Murray was around. Wawrinka was around. There were other, you know, characters in the big three story. But they carried the game of tennis for two decades. And now here we are in 2025. Federer's retired. Nadal's retired. Djokovic is not sure if he's even going to play next year. He said, I'm not sure if this was my last French Open. So Djokovic's future's in doubt despite him being a top five player in the world. But we didn't know where the game of tennis was going to go. I know Alcaraz won some majors and Sinner won some majors, but we were looking for who's going to definitively be the next great rivalry, the next great players to carry the men's game forward. And last night was the official anointing of the great rivalry. We had Federer and Nadal. We had Nadal Djokovic. We had Federer and Djokovic. We had the big three with Murray, with Wawrinka. We had that for 20 years. And before that, there was Agassi and Sampras. And obviously, there was Connors and McEnroe and Borg in the 70s and 80s. There was even Lendl and Boris Becker in the 80s. There's just always been characters and rivalries in men's tennis. And the next one, I will confidently say, will be Alcaraz and Sinner. Now, this young kid, Fonseca, from Brazil, he's 18 years old. Everyone says he's going to be the next great player. Maybe he joins the mix. He played unbelievable at the French Open so early on in the tournament. He's 18 years of age. So maybe he becomes the Djokovic character when it was Federer and Nadal, and then there was this third guy trailing. He was a bit younger, and then he finally caught up to them. And then it was a big three. Maybe that's the next big three. Or maybe it's just these two. But if you watch the match and you watch the quality of the points and everything, they're some of the greatest tennis players I've ever seen. I could not get over the way how hard Sinner hits the ball, how accurate he is. And then just the shot making from Alcaraz is second to none. His drop shots are incredible. His forehand, it sounded like, I can't even describe. It was like a thunderous sound coming off both of their rackets. And they're in their early 20s. And there's only room for them to somehow, I don't know how you get better than yesterday, but to think we could have matches like that for the next 10 years is unbelievable. And now you got Alcaraz with five majors, Sinner with three majors. They're number one and two in the world. And people are saying, what's Alcaraz's best surface? I have no idea. He's won a major on each surface. He's won a U.S. Open. He's won two Wimbledons. He's won two French Opens already. And they asked Agassi over the weekend, what do you think his best surface is? Like, as crazy as it sounds, I know he grew up playing on clay. I think grass is his best surface because he hits the ball so hard and he loves the fast game, likes to hit winners. The grass, faster surface might help him. But still, it's just crazy to think that these guys are this good at such a young age. And the game of tennis is in such a good spot for the next little while. And I will give TNT credit. They spent a fortune on those rights to get the French Open rights away from NBC. They covered the whole tournament, and they got the A-team. They got both McEnroes. They got Patrick McEnroe, John McEnroe. They brought in Sam Querrey, who's a really good analyst. I thought he did a great job. I'm forgetting the other guy, Jim Courier. They had Jim Courier. They had a really good panel. They did the interviews with the players, which were funny and great, doing like what TNT does, like with Inside the NBA, like the NHL show they have. They made it funny, and the players really enjoyed it. So TNT, they did a really good job at doing the French Open. And my hope is, now that they're losing the NBA, they can spend some of that money and get more tennis tournaments. Not saying just majors, but Indian Wells is all on Tennis Channel, Miami. They should try and get a deal done for some of those thousands. They really should, because NHL is great, and that's a nice contract to have, and they get your March Madness games. Trust me, people, there's a lot more tennis fans than you think, and the numbers are going to come out. The amount of people watching the fourth and fifth set of that match yesterday, it's going to be pretty damn high. So I'm interested to see if TNT or a CBS or someone looks to pick up some of those ATP 1000 tournaments that have not been picked up. I know ABC and ESPN have a stranglehold on the other three majors, the Australian, Wimbledon, and the U.S. Open, but TNT did a great job with the French Open, and I want to see them pick up Indian Wells, Miami, Cincinnati, Toronto and Montreal. Get those tournaments. I'm not saying you have to pick up the Beijing or the Shanghai 1000s or the Paris 1000s. I get it. That's during football season. But you're telling me in March and in August and May, we can't get like big networks, big American networks picking up big tennis tournaments. And now you have Coco Gauff, who's a star in the U.S. now, just winning the French Open. Taylor Fritz is a top five player in the world. He's American. Francis Tiafoe had a great run here at Roland Garros. Sebastian Corda is a good player. There's a lot of good American players. So I want to see tennis more on these big networks. I do. And I honestly, just because how popular professional sports is right now and how big of a draw that French Open final was yesterday, I could see a deal getting done for sure. Here's Carlos Alcaraz at the podium after winning one of the great tennis matches of all time, going back to back at the French Open.
Well, this one was the most exciting match that I've played so far, without a doubt. I mean, today I think the match had had everything. Really good moments, really bad moments. Just really, really happy and proud about how I dealt with everything today. I mean, it wasn't easy. The first match that I came back from two sets to love down. I think it was a better occasion to do it in the final of a Grand Slam.
Carlos, congratulations. People will probably talk about this match as they talk about Borg against McEnroe at Wimbledon in 1980 and Federer and Nadal Wimbledon 2008. How does that make you feel to have entered tennis history like that?
Well, honestly, you know, if people put our match in that table, I mean, it's a huge honor. For me, I don't know if it is at the same level as those matches, because those matches are, you know, the history of tennis and the history of a sport. So I let the people to talk about it. If you know, for them are almost the same, but for me, I mean. Watch it from outside, or realizing what are they that matches, you know, in the history of tennis. I don't know if our match is in the same table as them, but just happy to put our match and our names in the history of the Grand Slams, in the history of Roland Garros, and I led the discussion to the people.
So that's Carlos Alcaraz after winning his second French Open title, his fifth major. The final score, 4-6, 6-7, 6-4, 7-6, 7-6, and 10-2 in the final tiebreak. Unbelievable. Now I'm jacked. I cannot wait for the Wimbledon in a few weeks' time. And what's really great about this time of year is you get the French, and then it's immediately into the grass court season, which is really short. It's like one or two prenup tournaments, and then it's Wimbledon. And then right after Wimbledon, okay, there's a little bit of a break, but then in August, you get so many good tournaments. You get Cincinnati right before the U.S. Open. Obviously, you get Montreal and Toronto. I think this year Montreal have the women. But it's just a really good tennis schedule heading into the U.S. Open in around Labor Day weekend. But we're halfway through the Grand Slam season. And trust me, everyone is going to be praying for what we saw yesterday in a month's time, center court at Wimbledon. And Alcaraz be going for three in a row at Wimbledon. For a guy who didn't play a grass tournament before playing Wimbledon when he was younger, has won two Wimbledons. He didn't grow up playing on grass. He hardly played on grass until he was a pro. And he absolutely loves the surface. So he's going for three in a row at Wimbledon. And Sinner, he was, what, a point away from getting three legs of the Grand Slam. And it would have been who's getting the career Grand Slam first, because all Alcaraz is missing is Australia. And then if Sinner won that match yesterday, all he'd be missing is Wimbledon. Sinner would be looking to hold all four majors at Wimbledon. That's how good these guys are at such a young age. They're picking off majors left and right. And we had, what was it? I forget the stat. It was 60 out of 66 majors. Something crazy that Federer, Nadal, and Djokovic had. And that's still with Andy Murray. If Andy Murray was in any other era, he would have just had a double-digit wins. And it's Stan Wawrinka was so good. And he picked off two or three. And he was constantly in quarterfinals, losing to Federer, losing to Djokovic, losing to Nadal. Just there were so many great quality players in that era, and it did not matter. And in this era, nothing against Zverev, nothing against Tsitsipas, but those guys had their little window a few years ago. 2020, 2021, Casper Ruud, guys like that, they have no shot to win multiple majors with these guys around. Sinner and Alcaraz are on another level, and then I think, but what I've seen, and based on how young he is and how good he is, that Brazilian kid Fonseca might join the party too. But I love Shapovalov, and I love Felix Auger-Aliassime. I love these Canadian players. They are nowhere near that level. We're talking about this young generation, Canadian tennis. I'm sorry, that they had their three-year, they had the 2019, 2018, 2020. That was their window when Alcaraz and Sinner were late teenagers. But since 2022 and 2023, it's been all these guys. They've now won the last six majors. Alcaraz is five. He's 22. If he stays healthy and him and Sinner stay healthy, they're going to win 10, 15, who knows, maybe even 20 majors if they stay healthy. That's how good these guys are. And no one's close. No one's remotely close. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll preview a bit of the U.S. Open, which tees up Thursday from Oakmont. Is it Scottie Scheffler's tournament to lose, or do Rory McIlroy and Bryson DeChambeau has something to say about it? We will get into that next, as well as talk a bit about Aaron Rodgers signing with the Pittsburgh Steelers. I'm Tommy Lane for the Tommy John Show. Back after this quick word from our sponsors. Do not go away.
Suoni Pearl Popolo and Dreamscapes on CJLO present 10 Years of Metonymy Press, a cabaret, live at Casa del Popolo on Sunday, June 22nd at 8 p.m. For 10 years, Metonymy Press has been publishing queer, trans, and feminist literature by emerging writers, trying to reduce barriers for authors who interrogate the status quo to produce stunning, multi-genre books that reframe power and affirm life. This decade of Metonymy Press will be celebrated in the company of H. Felix Chow Bradley, Shanice Nicole, Kamala Mackerel, Trish Sala, Eli Tarek L. Bechelani Lynch, Kai Cheng Tom, and Jia King Wilson Yang. Don't miss out. Tickets and more information can be found on SwoniePearlPopolo.org, and keep listening to CGLO for more features on everything Swoney related.
Tune in to Fukubukuro on Saturdays at 8 p.m. for your weekly grab bag of music from Japan, East Asia, and everywhere else. Only on CJLO 1690 AM.
Under my thumb, the girl who once had
Back here on Tommy John Show. The U.S. Open this week. I'm sorry. I still can't believe that tennis match from yesterday. That was unbelievable. To think he saved three match points and then broke again. It's just unbelievable. But we'll quickly move over to the U.S. Open. And congrats to Ryan Fox. He got the job done in Canada yesterday. Four playoff holes to take down Sam Burns. And Sam Burns will be kicking himself. He had that, five-footer on the first playoff hole to win. And just never in a million years I would have thought he missed that putt. They said he was the best putter on tour. Just makes no sense how he misses that. It's a five-footer uphill. I was stunned. And Sam Burns, he lost. I don't even think it's the money that matters. It's the exemption into all the other tournaments. It would have helped him make the Ryder Cup team. That is a big putt he missed. If he wins the Canadian Open, he's exempt for all the majors, for not just this year, for next year as well. He would have been it would have given him so many more points for the Ryder Cup team. That was a missed opportunity for Sam Burns, who was a really talented player, really good player, has won multiple times on tour. Really stunned. But Ryan Fox, since coming to the PGA Tour, he won in Myrtle Beach a few weeks ago, and now wins the RBC Canadian Open. So we head to Oakmont, one of the great U.S. Open venues, and this course looks impossible. I don't know, and I'm really excited for it. As great as the other majors are, I'm not saying the U.S. Open's my favorite major. That has to be the Masters. It's April, Augusta National, the Azaleas, the history at that golf course, everything. You would have to say the Masters. But the U.S. Open, to me, is the most interesting because each week we see on the PGA Tour or LIV, these guys are so good now. They're at 18 under par, 20 under par. Remember Scottie Scheffler at the Byron Nelson, 31 under par. It's just getting out of hand. They come to a U.S. Open, and the last few years, the winner's been, 5 under? 4 under? And looking at the setup for Oakmont this week, them dropping the balls in the rough, you're dead. You're making bogey. And the greens, the way they undulate and they swing, I think even 1 under wins you the golf tournament, unless someone just puts on a clinic, like a Scottie Scheffler just hitting it in the middle of the fairway, green, 2-putt, occasionally make a birdie, okay, maybe they can go low. But looking at this golf course, I don't see it. And if the elements play a factor too, if it rains, if the wind's bad, we're looking at over par winning the golf tournament. We really are. And heading in, the big storyline obviously will be Rory. What's going on with Rory? Since winning the Masters, has not really looked too good. Having problem with his driver. Missed the cut of the Canadian Open. He looked bad. Really bad. And he said, at least I'm getting more practice in. But yeah, it's a bit concerning. We'll see what Rory does at Oakmont. And considering how dominant he is with the driver, him not hitting fairways at a U.S. Open could be a disaster, especially at Oakmont. At Pinehurst last year, it was that sandy little fescue area. You can still kind of get up and down from the rough. Oakmont, you have no chance. If you hit the if you hit the rough off every tee, you're shooting high 70s, maybe even 80. This rough is so thick, and there's no chance. You're just hacking the ball out of the rough on greens that are glass. It's crazy. So, Rory, that's a concern. The other big storyline is, can Scottie continue this run of dominance? Because as great as Rory was to start the year, and you can still argue Rory's the player of the year, they have the same amount of wins. Rory is one at Pebble, won the Players, the fifth major, they call it, the Indian Wells of men's tennis, and then won the Masters. Scottie has won 3 in 4 starts, so he's heating up and he's heading in that direction to run away with Player of the Year. But he has Byron Nelson, nothing against it, wasn't the strongest field, the PGA Championship and Memorial. So they both have an elevated event, they both have a major, and then Scottie's other win's Byron Nelson, and Rory's other win is the Players, which is above an elevated event. It's the fifth major. So that's why I would slightly favor Rory for Player of the Year right now. But as it looks like now, Scottie's going to run away with it because he's going to win 3 more times this year easily. And he is 2/3 of the way home for the Grand Slam, too. Excuse me, he's halfway. If he gets this one, he's 75% there. He is halfway right now. Once the one at Augusta the last few years, one in 2024, 2022, just won his third major. If he wins at Oakmont, and he is the heavy favorite at Oakmont, I'm seeing like plus 250. Plus 250 to win a golf tournament? Plus 250? If he wins this golf tournament, he's heading into the Open Championship at Portrush, which if he wins the U.S. Open, he will be the heavy favorite to win there to complete the career Grand Slam. Already. And Scotty's the kind of guy, he wins golf tournaments, like, yeah, it's great, but he's just on to the next one. He's a machine. He's a golfing machine right now. And I completely understand why people say you're foolish not to take Scottie Scheffler. And right now you would be. As much as I want Rory to win, he's not playing well. And as much as I want a Nick Taylor or a Corey Connors, a Canadian, to be up there in the leaderboard, they're not playing as well as Scottie Scheffler. The only other name I'm hearing is Bryson just because of the rough. He won the U.S. Open last year, won the U.S. Open at Wingfoot, which was a similar setup. I understand that. But to me, it's Scottie Scheffler and everyone else. And there's only, I think, two par fives. It's a par 70. It's going to be a tough test. I couldn't believe the length of the par threes. Rory was hitting like a 5-wood or a 3-wood and like a 280-yard par 3. The course is playing outrageously tough, which I like to see because nothing against the Canadian Open and nothing against the Byron Nelson and nothing against these other golf tournaments. I don't want to see the winning score at 31 under par and it's a birdie fest. I want to see these great players who are phenomenal struggle a little bit. Making hard pars. Fighting, just great up and downs. You hit into the rough, hack out sideways, hit a good wedge to 10 feet and make a par putt. I don't want a 30 under par winner at a major. The Masters is usually around 11 under, 10 under. The PGA now has gone a bit tougher, like 8 under, 11 under. The Open Championship can go anywhere from like 16 under to 5 under. The U.S. Open, 5 under is really low. We've seen winners over par at U.S. Opens. The whole point of a U.S. Open is to make the toughest test of the year. And looking at Oakmont, I don't think it's even close. This is by far the toughest course they will play all year. The thickest rough they'll play all year. And up there with Augusta, the fastest greens they will play all year. So right now, my pick would be Scottie Scheffler, but that's not we're going on a limb. But look at this Ryan Fox guy. I think he'll be in the hunt. He's a great ball striker. He hits fairways. That is the name of the game if you want to be in contention at the U.S. Open. Hit fairways and hit good iron shots. That's why I think Colin Morikawa can be in the mix too. He's great off the tee. His putting is not great. But if you can make pars on this golf course, you're going to be in it. If you shoot 70-70-70, you'll be probably a shot back or two back going into Sunday, shooting par. So that is the name of the game for everyone. And trust me, you're going to hear it all week at the podium, all just trying to make par, trying to save par, which I think is fun in 2025. No Byron Nelson 31 under pars here. No 8 under, 9 under round. No. Shoot even. Scramble to make one over. People shooting one over are going to be in the golf tournament. I'm interested to see what the cut will be. Is it going to be 8 over, 10 over? I don't know. But the way the course looks right now, and just hearing how the players are talking about the golf course and the setup, this tournament is going to be almost impossible to shoot under par at. That's what I'm hearing. So I can't wait for that. We're going to take our second break. And when we come back, we'll talk about Aaron Rodgers signing with the Pittsburgh Steelers and what I think rightful expectations should be for him in his first year in Pittsburgh. I'm Tommy Lane for the Tommy John Show. Back after this quick word from our sponsors. Do not go away.
CJLO is proud to present Initial Shock, Montreal's noise festival, featuring artists such as Mass Marriage, Deaf Neil, Apologist, Matriarch, Anne F. Jacques, Taskmaster, and many more. Initial Shock takes place on July 5th at La Sartorena and July 6th at Petit Ours. Advance tickets available now at initialshock.screamandrive.com. Proudly presented by CJLO.
Push that button.
How about this one?
Say something quick. The security guard coming.
What?
Say something quick.
Say what?
The Caribbean Callaloo, the 2 times award-winning show on CJLO. 1690 on your AM dial every Saturday from 2 p.m. till 4 p.m. 514-848-7471.
Who's that girl, boy?
You can't talk, but you can see her.
Back here on the Tommy John Show. So, yeah. Aaron Rodgers is a Pittsburgh Steeler. And we all knew it was going to happen once we saw where other quarterbacks were going. Once we saw Kirk Cousins wasn't really going to go anywhere immediately. Once Sam Darnold heads out the door to Seattle. Once Fields goes to the Jets. We were slowly putting it all together. Like, well, the only spot Aaron can go is Pittsburgh. And maybe it's Minnesota, but we know they love J.J. McCarthy. They trade up into the top 10 to get him. And once it was established, J.J. McCarthy's the guy in Minnesota. Aaron signs in Pittsburgh. Now, the Steelers defensively are still one of the great teams in the NFL. They spend more on defense than anyone. Cameron Hayward and Watt and Minka Fitzpatrick, and it goes on and on and on and on, the amount of stars they have on that defense. And they win football games. You can give Mike Tomlin all of the hate in the world when it comes to him losing in the first round of the playoffs. Oh, he can't win the big game. Oh my God. Even though he's won a Super Bowl, people forget. He's won a Super Bowl. Oh, so long ago. They just lose in the big games. They get to the playoffs and lose. Well, how many teams would take getting to the playoffs? Ask Jet fans. It's been 14, 15 years since they've been in the playoffs. What are we doing here? The Steelers win 9 to 10 games a year, every year. Teams would kill for that. The Jets would kill for that. The Cleveland Browns would kill for that. Ask anyone. Maybe you'll find a spoiled Chiefs fan, or maybe like me, a Patriots fan who's used to winning all these Super Bowls. The Steelers win football games. Now, going into this year, as great as their defense one, okay, is, as great as DK Metcalf is or a receiver, you know, they had Mason Rudolph at quarterback. Now they bring in Aaron Rodgers, who looked better at the end of the year than he did earlier in the year. Seems like he was getting more comfortable with his Achilles. He looked far better week, not even close, week 16, 17, 18 than he did weeks 4 through 10. And that is a fact. And really what it comes down to, as crazy as Aaron Rodgers is, as much ayahuasca as he does, as many podcasts as he does with these weird hosts, he is a better quarterback than Mason Rudolph. It's not even close at 41, at 42 years of age. He's miles better than Mason Rudolph. And the Steelers are in a win-now mode. They have an expensive defense. Cameron Hayward's getting old. TJ Watt's getting older. They just gave DK Metcalf a fortune. They had to go get Aaron Rodgers. They had to. There's no two ways around it. He was the best QB on the market by a wide, wide margin. So I credit the Steelers for getting it done. I do. Thank you for joining us this week on the Tommy John Show. Next week, we'll recap the U.S. Open and talk more about the Stanley Cup Finals and NBA Finals. I'm Tommy Lane. Thank you guys for listening.